Pseudopod, episode 253, October 28th, 2011. This week's story, Trying to Stay Dead, by Richard S. Crawford. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I remain, as ever, Alistair, and your story this week crawls from an appropriately ancient and drafty house in Sacramento, as well as from the mind of Richard S. Crawford. Richard lives there with his wife and six technically normal cats, and for a while this story, which had never escaped the house up until this week. Now, of course, it's out there in the world, somewhere close to the meat. You can find Richard at www.underpope.com. And now, Alistair is going to sit still and listen attentively, because Richard is going to tell us a story, and we should all pay attention, because we are told this story is true.
Trying to Stay Dead, by Richard S. Crawford. Dr. Bell's assistant led me into the tiny exam room and gestured at the leather-padded chair in the center. "Are you ready to do this?" she asked, smiling. I hesitated. I've been psyching myself up for an anemectomy for 2 months, but now the exam room gave me pause. It reminded me of a dentist's office. The chair in the center of the room sat benignly beneath a single circular lamp that could be moved and aimed in any direction, while beside it lurked a movable desk with a tiny computer and a single instrument that looked like a dentist's drill. "I suppose." "You're nervous, I can tell." The assistant wore a simple pink smock, the kind dental and mental hygienists all over the world wore. Her teeth gleamed an almost unnatural shade of white, and her silky brown hair cascaded lushly over her shoulders. She looked like a model. And why not? The tiny scar on her left temple and the ever so slightly unfocused look in her eyes told me she'd already had the snip. She acted happy and well-adjusted and was unaware of anything she or I were saying or doing. "A little," I replied. "I mean, I'm ready. Really, I am. It just seems weird. It's so final, you know?" "It's not weird at all." The name tag on her blouse read Sammy. "I had it done 3 years ago, and I'm sure I was as nervous as you. But it's so easy. You don't feel a thing. It looks scary, but all you do is just sit here. The doctor does his job, and snip, you're done." "You make it sound so simple." I tried a brave smile, but it felt clumsy. I sat down and tried to get comfortable. "You won't feel a thing." Sammy pressed me back gently against the chair, then leaned over me, giving me a generous show of perfect cleavage. She strapped me in, wrapping thick rubber straps around my legs, arms, and forehead. I was completely restrained. "That's just so you don't get surprised or jump or anything during the procedure," she explained. "There could be complications." I tried to nod, but I couldn't because of the band on my forehead. "I'm fine." Sammy stood up. "Okay, you're all ready. Dr. Bell will be with you in a moment." She left the room, and I watched her as she did so. Her ass was perfect. I closed my eyes and tried to relax. Maybe this was a stupid idea. Everyone I knew had gotten the snip, and they were all better people afterwards. Kinder, more thoughtful, they took better care of themselves, they got along better with everyone, and, unburdened with a sense of self, they were always smiling. But I couldn't help wondering if the snip wasn't just some sort of fancy lobotomy. Everyone who had had it done said that it was painless. On the other hand, how would they know? There was a polite knock at the door, and it opened before I had a chance to respond. In stepped a gargantuan man, a leviathan in a white coat, who had to stoop a little just to avoid hitting his head on the lintel. His face was smooth, half obscured by a magnificently long, impeccably trimmed beard. "Hello, Roger. I'm Dr. Bell. How are you?" I tried to show him I was perfectly at ease by smiling as broadly as I could. "A little nervous," I told him. "Oh, there's no cause for that. You won't feel a thing. I've performed this procedure close to 3,000 times. Any fatalities? None so far this week. My heart froze solid in my chest. Dr. Bell must have seen it, because he laughed. No, no fatalities, of course not. In fact, none of my patients have experienced any complications at all. He sat down on a wheeled stool. Let's just get started here. He turned a knob, and I felt a sharp pressure on my left temple. All right, are you ready? I gasped as the pressure on my temple suddenly grew deeper, then terminated in a loud crunch. Let me... Snip. Think about it for a moment more, Roger says. But even before he finishes the sentence, the procedure is done. He blinks. Wow, he says. The doctor smiles at him. There, see? That wasn't so bad at all. Roger looks around the room, a look of wonder on his face. He waves his hand in front of his face and repeats, Wow. You'll get used to it, Dr. Bell says. He takes a small pad of paper out of his lab coat pocket and scribbles on it. I'm going to give you some post-surgical care instructions. There shouldn't be any problems, but we want you to stay fit and healthy, of course. Here. He tears off the top slip of paper and hands it over. Roger looks at it. The instructions are to exercise, eat healthy, sleep well, and be happy. Dr. Bell smiles. Think you can do that? Of course, says Roger. This looks easy. It will be. Dr. Bell smiles one last time, gives Roger a friendly clap on the shoulder, and leaves the room. A moment later, Sammy returns. She unstraps Roger, helps him stand up, then gives him a big, friendly hug. Roger, smiling, returns it. He turns back to the desk and fills out the last of the paperwork. Then, still smiling, he leaves the office, looking like a man ready to start a new day and a new life. Roger spends his first few days after his procedure cleaning up his apartment. He has a lot of stuff. Nothing gets thrown away, but it gets all arranged, carefully, on shelves and in cubbies. He has hundreds of books and compact discs, as well as piles of magazines spread throughout the apartment. Between taking care of his body, cleaning up his apartment, and going to his job, he barely has time to spend with other people. On Friday night, his telephone rings. He picks it up and answers it. Hello, this is Roger. A woman's voice squeals at him from the earpiece. Oh my God, Roger, it's Teresa. You've had the snip, haven't you? It's so obvious. Roger nods. It wasn't so bad. There really wasn't anything to it at all. Everyone knows that, Roger. You're so funny. Hey, you want to get together? Go on a date tonight? You've been attracted to me for a long time, but, well, you know. Roger smiles. Of course I would, Teresa. Nothing would make me happier. Great. I'll pick you up at your apartment in half an hour, okay? I know you're probably still getting used to things. Therese and Roger say their goodbyes. I hung up the phone and looked at it for a moment, happy to hear from Teresa, then goes to his bedroom to get ready. Dinner at the restaurant is well prepared, and the movie that Teresa takes Roger to is full of spectacle and music. He doesn't think about dinner during the movie, and after the movie he doesn't reflect on it. But that's okay, because everything is good. He looks at Teresa with a smile. And when she looks at him, he blushes and looks away. Teresa smiles. Would you like to come back to my place? I can feel my heart in my throat, and I said, sure. Then Roger shakes his head in momentary confusion. Are you okay? Teresa asks. Everything's fine, Roger says. There was just a little... He pauses, then shrugs. His smile returns. Teresa shrugs. That happens sometimes, she says. Sometimes after the snip there's some slipping. It's nothing to worry about. Come on, let's go. She takes his hand. Roger follows, the smile never leaving his face. For a couple of weeks, things are great. Roger and Teresa meet just about every night, have dinner, and go home to have sex. They talk about the things that couples talk about, the things they are expected to talk about, what they enjoy doing, their future together, and so on. They agree that if they have children, the children will have the snip done as early as possible. On a Thursday night, 2 weeks after Roger's procedure, Roger and Teresa have sex as usual. The smiles on their faces and the noises they make are high-pitched and full of laughter. But toward the end, Roger pauses, because I suddenly felt full of joy. I tried to ignore it. For a moment I did, and Roger goes back to the task. But I couldn't keep it up. I withdrew from Teresa and lay down next to her. Roger, Teresa says. She leaned over me and gave me a kiss. Are you all right? I shook my head, trying to shake this thing out of me. I wasn't sure how to say it. The snip didn't take, Teresa said. Roger smiles. No, it's fine, he starts to say. But then I couldn't finish. She was right. It had been happening every now and then for almost a week now. I've been ignoring it, trying to deny it. But there was no more doing so. I'm so sorry, Teresa says. I blinked and looked over at her. My heart sank. After the snip, everything had been so nice. No awareness, no doubts, nothing. But now it had worn off. I felt like a huge weight had been placed onto my chest. I struggled and tried to bring back the feeling that the snip had brought me. Don't be sorry, Roger says. But the feeling only lasted for a moment. Teresa's eyes did not focus on me perfectly. I knew that behind them there was no consciousness, no animus, no sentience, no experience of qualia or sensation, nothing but pre-existent behaviors and complex reflexes, a set of programs to give the illusion of personality and happiness. It was truly bliss. Roger tries to bring it back inside himself, but I wasn't able to, not fully. Go back to the doctor, Teresa said. He can fix you again. Come and make love to me again. I tried, but it was hard, knowing that she was not experiencing any of it, only acting. It was better for me the first time around, when I didn't feel it and was unaware that it was happening. Sammy was just as beautiful as the first time I'd come in, but I was too depressed to give her more than a passing glance. She led me into Dr. Bell's office and gestured at the leather chairs in front of the desk. Sit down, she said. She smiled just as beautifully as the first time I'd seen her, white teeth flashing. And why shouldn't she? She had nothing at all to worry about. She was incapable of worry. Dr. Bell will be in just a moment. She left the office and closed the door behind her. I looked around Dr. Bell's office. Everything here was in perfect order. Texts by Yablo, Chalmers, Blackwell, Nagel, and Kripke lined the bookshelves, all pioneers in the field of anatomological studies, who had paved the way for further philosophical work and for the snip itself. Dr. Bell opened the door and stepped into the room. Well, hello, Roger. How are you? Pretty miserable, Doctor. The snip didn't take. I want to schedule another one. Sighing, Dr. Bell sat down behind his desk. He shook his head. I'm afraid that's not possible, he said. Spontaneous reversal of the snip isn't unknown. We're still not sure how it happens. An ontological mutation to the essential phenomenological construct, we think, which causes a spontaneous reintegration of the internal experience of self. Some sort of Cartesian impairment, perhaps. Can you fix it? I'm afraid not. Phenomenological deconstructs hindered by ontological deformations are notoriously difficult to treat. The best experimental philosophers have struggled with the problem, but all attempts to establish a full physiological denial of the self experience have failed. No matter what we do, the self always returns. I hadn't understood a single word of what he said. What? Dr. Bell smiled condescendingly. In brief, no. Every once in a great while, the snip restores itself spontaneously, and in those cases, only partially. But I wouldn't count on that. I sank down into my chair. Don't worry. Many people have gone on to live full and complete lives, despite being burdened with an awareness of self. I can recommend a series of exercises and techniques to help you overcome it. With time and patience, you may find that you can experience brief periods of, "No," I said, "I'm not interested. If I can't have the real thing, I don't want it at all." "Very well," Dr. Bell said, looking directly at me. "Then is there anything else I can do for you?" I shook my head. Every part of my body felt heavy, as if made of stone. Still, I forced myself to stand up. "Thanks for everything," I said. He waved at me, and I left. I tried to get together with Teresa once more, because it seemed like her presence helped me just a bit to recover the senselessness that I'd felt just after the snip. But I couldn't. She was sweet, but there was just something there that she and I couldn't be part of together. I broke things off with her, and she cried, but felt no sadness. She acted sad, with tears and a runny nose. But inside, I knew there was nothing at all. I could at least console myself with that knowledge, even if it would never be true for me. She was a beautiful woman. I knew it wouldn't take long for another snipped man to find her. And even if none ever did, she would never be unhappy. I let my own life fall to pieces. Overpowered by my sense of self, I gave up on eating well, on exercising, on sleeping. I gained back the weight I had lost. Blemishes reappeared on my face. I tried to keep up with my job, but I kept getting distracted by things I felt, things I became aware of, such as my own thoughts and feelings. After a while, I just gave up. Everyone else in the office had had the snip, and they all seemed so happy. None of them could share my burden. I felt nauseous. Finally, I could take it no more. I went to the edge of town on a Wednesday night to where the Emperor Norton Bridge connected San Augustine with the other side of the bay. I drove halfway across the bridge, then got out of my car and stood at the edge, leaning over the railing and looking down at the water. "Hey there," said a voice to my right. I turned. A young woman, hair red like fire and wearing a simple white dress, stood on the edge of the bridge, just a few feet to my right. Her bare toes dangled precariously, but she seemed to maintain her balance with no effort. Her left temple was smooth and unscarred, and she looked directly at me. "Are you going to jump?" she asked. "That's the plan." "Why?" I sighed. How could I possibly explain myself? It's a long story. She peered at me, her eyes boring directly into mine. The snip didn't take, did it? No, it didn't. "And so you're here about to kill yourself?" "It's the agony of being," I blurted out, unable to contain myself. "I just wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to be able to not care, to just ignore everything and not worry about anything." "Oh," she said. "Well, that's perfectly reasonable." "Yeah, I've had the taste of emptiness, of the state of non-being, while still being here. I can't take this constant awareness of myself, especially knowing that everyone else around me is unburdened with it." I hadn't realized it, but my voice was actually getting louder as I spoke. I took a breath to calm myself. For a moment, the two of us stood in perfect silence, letting the wind blow over us. "Wow," she breathed at last. "What magnificent bullshit."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Oh, nothing. I mean, I've heard some real lame excuses to commit suicide before, but that one was one of the worst. You should have thrown in an unrequited love, a crushing debt, or at least a dead puppy."
agony of being? She scoffed. Pathetic. Well, what about you? What's your excuse? For what? For killing yourself? I'm not. Then why are you here? She smiled. I'm just here to enjoy the night air. Isn't it wonderful? Whatever. Just go about your business, all right? Pretend I'm not here. Fucker, I thought. I stepped over the railing and looked out over the ocean. The water down there was awfully choppy and looked very cold. Of all bridges in California, the Emperor Norton Bridge had the lowest suicide survival rate, and the city had done nothing about it, aside from plastering a few flyers with a number of a local suicide hotline. The woman yawned loudly.
Are you gonna take all night?
Fuck you, I said. I said it to the woman on the bridge. I said it to the bridge. I said it to the ocean, to the cities on either side of the bridge. I said it to the world, to God, to Dr. Bell, to Teresa and Sammy, to mutagenic phenomenologies. I said it to my brain. I said it to a universe which wouldn't allow me to let go of myself, and which made me hang on to a consciousness that I never asked for and never wanted. Fuck you, I repeated. Then I said it again, just for good measure. Fuck you. She stared. Please don't do it, she said. Annoyed, I let go of the railing and took a step out over the open water. Then, before I could have a chance to back out, I took another. And then I was falling. I heard the girl screaming behind me. I'm not sure what I expected. The wind rushed past my ears and onto my face. The way my hair flew around myself and the freshness of the salty air were exhilarating. I closed my eyes and savored the moment, then opened my eyes and looked down. The water rushed up to me with a malignant solidity I would never have been able to foresee. My heart leaped in my chest.
This was the wrong idea.
Snip, you say aloud, and then your body slams into the water and you stop. But it's not the end. You survive, but just barely. Your internal organs are damaged. Your hip is broken and refuses to heal. You live in a chair. Teresa comes to visit you from time to time, but never stays for long. She is sympathetic to your situation, but finds you too self-involved, and eventually stops showing up altogether. The girl from the bridge also comes to visit you sometimes as well. She, too, is sympathetic, but she finds you too distant. In the end, it's just you. And despite the constant pain, you are almost happy.
I so wanted to be flashy. I honestly wanted to write this entire intro like I'd had the snip. You know, Alistair is particularly impressed by the use of second person as a means of differentiating post-snip from pre-snip individuals, and I'm particularly impressed with the way the story uses the shift in tense to show how the snip starts to fail. But that's like pulling a bigger rabbit, or perhaps a rabbit holding some flowers, out of the same hat a consummate professional has just pulled a rabbit out of on stage. It's good, but you're still busy going, holy crap, did you see that? Did you see him pull a Buick out of that soft drink can? So this is me not being flashy. This is me standing to one side of your podcast and going, holy crap, did you just hear that? That is flat out one of the most elegant ways of using text I've heard in years. Chilling too, especially as it speaks to a central idea that's haunted me ever since I heard the Fifth Doctor say that a man is the sum of his memories. A Time Lord even more so. We're empty shells, with nothing but our experiences and memories to define where we were, are, and are going to. The self is an accumulation, a Katamari Damacy ball of experiences and memories and sensations that is defined as much by what isn't in there as what is. If that shell ever breaks, if that ball ever gets out of control, then all we're left with is the space where our memories used to be, the ghost of armor and straps whispering at our skin, telling us we're no longer protected. We're no longer undercover. Naked in the rain, surrounded by a world which is either hungry and awake or just can't bring itself to give a damn. and we have no idea which is worse. The self is weak and fragile and easily broken. It's the lie we tell ourselves so we can move in a pack. Or at the very least, the self is detachable, like a coat you can take off when it gets too hot or is out of fashion. You see, the self isn't just mutable. The self is disposable and crucially non-essential, and that's the chilling premise here. And it's one which will stay with me for a long time. We're defined by our absences, defined by our pain as much as we are our successes. If you take those away, then you destroy us. It's that simple. But if you put them at one remove, then superficially, you get more perspective, more peace, a little critical distance. The thing is, though, critical distance never helps, and that new perspective comes with a price tag. Action, which requires awareness of what you could gain as well as what you could lose, and being able to be aware of those things requires the self. Doesn't mean you have to like it, though. There are bits of our personalities we all hate. The things that make us weak and craven and stupid, that show our worst sides to the world, even when we try and tell ourselves we're showing our best. There are moments where we fall, or the blame falls on us. All we can do is take it. All we can do is add it to the shell. The self, some assembly required. So, whilst the idea of slipping into a painless, positive world of second person has some appeal, I'm going to stay here. It's noisy, and it's messy. But it's mine, not Alistair's. Whereas the servers that power our ghastly Doom engines, and also the toaster, and the accounts that pay our authors are not mine, but rather things I serve as the willing weekly custodian of. Please, if you can spare the money, donate to Feed the Pod on pseudopod.org. All we do with that cash is cover server costs and pay our authors, so each cent you send will instantly go to help with something cool and vital. But we're forgetting something. After all, it's almost Halloween, and that means the parade is here. The parade starts early this year. You can see the first signs of it form around the edges of the town. See the first balloons go up, the first skeletons on bags and clothes. Hear the first sing-song, trick or treat. The parade is coming, and this year the town is ready. It has to be, because this year the parade is bigger than ever before. There's a float first, which is new. A float bearing an altar, a rock which had been hammered flat and wide, and which holds a single cave bear skull. There's something stark about it, something powerful, and the altar almost seems to hum as it goes past. There are cheers, some jokes, not as many as usual. The people of the town know what's passing, and they know not to meet its eyes, or draw its attention. Behind that comes Pliny the Younger, excitedly discussing the relative merits of ghosts versus pagans as the monster in horror fiction, with Bede, who perhaps looks just a little bit shifty. Behind them, Machiavelli discusses the relative merits of courtly intrigue, with a prince, not his prince, the one who can't seem to decide whether to be angry or sad, maniacal or crippled with grief. He can't seem to decide on his face either. His features keep changing, tall and dark-haired one minute, older and stockier and blonder the next. Behind him, an old man dressed like an advisor looks daggers at the prince, utterly failing to notice the look on his son's face. The younger man keeps pace with his father, talks like him, moves like him. It's invisible to him. They both hate the variable prince in front of them. That much is certain, but as they pass, it becomes clear that that may not be enough. Behind them come the mad old kings, the three old men arguing over who had the worst life, whilst behind them come their victims, the drowned and the mutilated, the savaged and the betrayed, the children and the bastards, a litany of lives crushed because a man with a crown had a bad day. All of them look murder at the backs of the kings. None of them are noticed. It could be worse, of course, because behind them come the revengers, and their victims, the bloody tragedies lost in the shadow of one man's pen, or two, depending on your point of view. And it's funny we should mention that, because to one side of them, not in the parade, but near it, there's a shadowy figure who seems to be controlling them, manipulating them, orchestrating their movements. We can't see his face, because he doesn't want us to. He He doesn't have it all his own way, though. Two men follow the crowd of Elizabethan horrors and victims, both dressed for the occasion and either hurrying to catch up with the prince or in no hurry to get near him at all. They can't seem to agree on which one is which, and one of them keeps coming up with inventions that can't possibly work. Or at least work yet. But they're alive, and they're unnoticed by the author. For now. Behind them, the parade digs in, bulking out into the occult consulting detectives and the poor, mad, blasted citizens of 1920s horror. People with eyes too big for their heads follow a man who appears to be talking to a cat who isn't there, and a group of terrified innocents clustered together either for protection or because that way the chances of someone else dying first are higher. Next to them, one man, his face not quite right, mumbles something about fungus. No one makes eye contact. Their faces are picked out, illuminated by the electric pentagram held aloft by the occult scientists. Carnacki's people have had a good year, and their numbers have been swelled both by Lovecraft himself and by a tall, precise man with a beaked nose and a long gait. The man who follows him, who is next to him, is clearly military, possibly medical, and utterly unconvinced by everything the occultists do. They don't mind, and as he passes by, you can tell neither does he. Not that he'd ever let his friends see that. The White Street Society follow on, trying to borrow money from them. They've not had any luck. Yet. Behind them come the vampires. All the vampires. The red-cloaked horrors, the feral, pallid beasts, the rank and file of the undead mixing in with their huge primal ancestors and their smaller, glittering cousins. The sparkling vampires get some looks, a few taunts. Not many. Because the 12 figures moving behind them and the shadowy legions they brought with them bring the stench of death. The death of a world. That unique aroma of tragedy and pain and horror and dust. The joy of someone else's blood on your face. No one watches until they go past. No one sees the two little girls following them, hand in hand. Both look sad. One looks fed. Behind them come the zombies, and the horde of the undead makes the vampire legion look tiny. The zombies who've come from them all, the zombies who still have their grave clothes on, the zombies that run, the zombies that shuffle, and around them, careful, frantic, fragile and human, come the survivors. There's the polite, harried blonde man with red on him, his doomed friends, his almost girlfriend. On the other side of the parade, an unusually similar group keeps pace with them. On one side, the friend trips. On the other, a second later, so does his twin. Behind them, the sheriff and his terrified band slope along, moving from shadow to shadow, place to place. The sheriff looks dead-eyed, fatigued. He keeps rubbing one hand, as though it's sore. The mood darkens as the zombies pass, but it lightens as classic rock blares out from not one, but two carts that lead the next stage of the parade. The two brothers may have different rides, and one has clearly seen better days, but they're travelling as one. In the back seat of one car sits a polite, serious-looking young man with dark hair and a trench coat. In the back of the other, a slightly older blonde man smiles serenely, leaning forward to whisper to the driver every now and then. Every time he does, the driver grows pale. Behind them, the Cockney magician is back, keeping pace with a scientist, a man in whose shadow plants grow and thrive, who looks like he can't decide whether to be delighted that he's there or horrified. Every time his step falters, the blonde magician claps him on the back, makes a joke, and the scientist chuckles, a little nervously. Then there's the townsfolk. Not the old, traditional townsfolk with their torches and pitchforks, no. These are the townsfolk of the new horror landscape. The polite barman with his dog's teeth and his idiot brother. The woman with glowing hands, observed by two vampires, one dark, one blonde. The staff of the bar. Ghosts flicker and dance around them, and the blonde vampire in particular, in a certain light, looks drenched in blood. None of it his. Then, of course, there's the new people. There's always the new people. The angry-looking surgeon whose cheerful wife is slightly transparent, being comforted by the odd, polite young lawyer who's explaining how technically he's not a prophet as such. The couple busy talking about their new house, busy laughing, neither making eye contact. Neither acknowledging how much the house and the things that live in it terrify them. And then there's the things on the edge of the parade. The half-formed terrors, the whispers of monsters and pain and death, all waiting to entertain us, all waiting under the bed, in the closet, behind the door. But not here. Not now. Not yet. Happy Halloween, everyone. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Join us next week for The Blood Garden by Jesse Livingston. We'll see you then. But first, Pseudopod must confess to being a little bit worried because the lights are on, but no one's home.